thank you very much for speaking with me today. I noticed that a lot of your career has been in Glasgow. Did you grow up in Glasgow? Do you have that connection here?
Yeah, I was born and brought up in Glasgow, went to school in Glasgow, and then moved away to go to university. But after kind of early stages of my career, I just wanted to come back to Glasgow. So,
and was there something early on that sparked your interest in science?
Several things, I guess. And it's probably quite topical because the 50th anniversary of the moon landings, I am that old that I remember. That was a very defining kind of moment of my childhood, actually, although I had an interest in science and particularly astronomy before that, encouraged initially by my father, who wanted me to be a mathematician. So I kind of got partway there, and then influential teachers at school. I went to an all-girls school, and that was, I think, at the time, very good for me because there was absolutely no kind of indication at that being educated that way that girls didn't do physics. And this was sort of in the late 60s, early 70s. So that was important. And then when I decided to do maths and physics joint, and at university I had a couple of very influential teachers who took me into the optics and lasers field.
And so your dad wanted you to be a mathematician. Was there some reason?
He was very interested. My parents grew up, they were children during the Second World War. They grew up, both of them grew up in quite not an affluent part of Glasgow. My dad left school at 14. He was a hugely able guy and could very easily have done a degree. Would have quite liked to have been a civil engineer, but he pursued a career, worked in the same business pretty much his whole life, but developed within that and did a lot of more like accountancy type work, but was interested in maths particularly. And I suppose he wanted to encourage me growing up at a later time to have the opportunities that he hadn't had. So yeah, big influence.
So you started your career with a bachelor's degree in physics at the University of Edinburgh, and then you went on to get a master's and PhD at Imperial College in London. What motivated you to continue in physics at that time, and what motivated you to move so you could have done, say, a master's at Edinburgh?
I was very interested in pursuing optics further, and I was encouraged by a lecturer, one of the lecturers at Edinburgh, a guy called Dick Sillitoe, who was a great optical physicist. At the time, there were two really good master's degrees in optics. It was either Imperial or Reading. I was interviewed for Imperial and really liked the setup, so that was what took me there.
Once you completed the master's, you decided to stay for the PhD there as well?
Yes, because the master's was only a year. The physics department at Imperial was a very good department. There was a wide range of opportunities, and there were opportunities to do a PhD in an area that I was interested in, which was practical laser physics for nonlinear optics.
Was that a fairly new field at that time?
I guess it was relatively new, but it didn't feel like that. I mean, there had been a laser physics research at Imperial for quite some time, so it was an established group. When I look back and I look at where the technology has got to now, I recognise with hindsight that the work that I was doing and the way that we were doing and the shape of experiments was actually quite new.
Yeah.
And the way we were working, I was working particularly with excimer lasers, ultraviolet gas lasers. I think they were relatively new. I can't remember exactly when they came along, but there was still quite a lot of challenges with just getting the technology to work at the time.
The group that you were in, was it a large research group? And your advisor, it sounds like he was well established there. He'd been there for a while. I'm assuming it's a he.
Yes.
And were there many postdoctoral researchers in the group? I guess what I'm sort of getting at is how that group was managed.
The laser physics group had two arms. They were led by lecturers or senior lecturers. That was my PhD supervisor. But within the group, there were probably about three, maybe four different kind of threads of research interest. Each of those had maybe one postdoc, maybe two, but there were also PhD students who were at a later stage. So when I started my PhD, I worked with a couple of guys who were coming towards the end, so they were sort of third year. So they kind of fulfilled that more direct help in the lab, getting established, that kind of thing. So I'd say overall the group was probably about 15.
So it was a sizable.
It was a sizable group.
And did you find that at all awkward? I imagine there weren't that many women in the group.
No, there weren't that many women. There was, I'm just trying to remember actually, there was a woman in the other side of the group, or there was also a theory group as well. In my area, there was actually at that time a female visitor who was from a French research group, and she was a senior researcher, so she wasn't an academic. She worked in a government lab in France, and she was part of the group for quite a while. I guess that was quite helpful. But I had come through, you know, my undergraduate, there were not many women, so by my final fourth year physics, I was the only woman in 22. I guess I was used to that.
You were used to it. It didn't bother you?
No, not particularly.
After your PhD, you moved to Cambridge and worked in a technical consultancy group. Would you say that was your first real job?
Yes. Yeah.
Did you have any jobs while you were growing up? Part-time,
yes.
Summer jobs, you did. But were they at all science and technology related?
A mixture. In the summers at the end of my third and fourth year in undergraduate, I had sort of science-related jobs. So I had one summer working in Barron Stroud, which is now Thales. They had a commercial laser department. I worked there for a summer. It was interesting to be in that environment. And I had a job one summer with a technical company in Edinburgh, but I also had jobs working in shops, working in an office.
So that first job, how did you make the connection to that company?
I saw an advert.
Oh, is that, yeah?
Yeah, I had actually decided that I was not going to stay in academia. And I probably decided that by about the midpoint of my PhD, I struggled with my PhD for quite a long time. I ended up leaving. I had come to the end of my studentship and I had finished my lab work, but I hadn't fully written up. I'd had a short postdoc, but my funding ran out and I needed a job, and I knew that I wasn't going to stay in academia. But what I was interested in was the practical application of what I was doing, and I enjoyed the science and I didn't want to move away from that completely. I just saw a job advert, I think probably in a physics world or something like that, for this technical consultancy company. I didn't know anything about them. I got an interview and I got the job.
That's great. While you were working there, were you still writing up your thesis? Yeah.
Yeah.
So that might have been kind of a difficult time, or was it easier? No, it wasn't easier.
It was not easier.
Having your attention split between two things didn't make it easier to get it done.
It was very difficult.
Sure.
It took me another 2 years to write up, and there certainly were times when I didn't think I would finish it. Difficult being away from the lab, difficult not being able to do sort of any additional work.
Measurements and things.
Yeah, difficult having, just finding the time to write properly. The guy that I worked for used to occasionally send me home for a week. He'd say, go home, Karen, and write up. And a week was not going to help.
Yeah.
But it was the support was there to get it done, and I did eventually get it done. So the job was, when I joined, was quite technical. So we were doing things. We had laser labs. We were developing laser systems for commercial companies. We worked on, for example, the very early development of ultraviolet lasers for corneal reprofiling. So it was exciting and it was interesting work, and I found it much more interesting than doing my PhD.
It's okay to say that.
And so, good colleagues.
In that position, you had just finished the lab work, maybe I would say, for your PhD. It sounds like straight away you were managing a project. Yeah, and developing medical lasers. So you manage the technical part of the project as well as sales and marketing.
It was actually quite an unusual setup, the way that we worked. So we had a team, it was called the Applied Physics Team, but we were largely all laser or optics people. There was probably about 10 of us. The way that we operated, two really interesting things. One, it was largely interdisciplinary. When we had a project, a team would be put together that included somebody from applied physics, if you needed it, somebody from electronics, somebody from mechanical engineering. So you were straight away working with colleagues across the organisation. Initially, I didn't get involved in the selling side of it, although I did later, as I sort of got more experience, I got involved in selling, but it was the more senior staff that did that. Once the project had been won, they put together the appropriate team. And the person who led the team could be anybody. So there was a difference between rank and role. So you had a particular, I was an engineer initially and then a senior engineer. But in that role, I could be a project leader, and I could have people on that team who were more senior to me, who were consultants or senior consultants, but just depended on the specific project. So that was actually a really good experience. Sometimes a bit thrown in at the deep end, but overall, that was a good experience.
In that group, you were still doing research in developing
development, I would say, rather than research.
Rather than research, more development. There's an unpredictable element to it. You're not just repeating something. You're doing something that hasn't been done before. And that can sometimes lead to obstacles or challenges that you didn't anticipate.
Nothing that we did was routine. So we were always kind of pushing the boundaries a bit in terms of what we could deliver. When you're working for a client, then you've got client expectations to manage. But also you want to try and deliver a novel solution or an innovative solution or push things forward a bit. So, yeah, there'd be a bit of a balance there. The hours, were longish and quite a bit of travelling as well. So the client we were working with on the corneal reprofiling was a US company.
So you don't remember the hours as being incredibly long, but maybe there were deadlines where things would get extended at certain times, it would go longer.
Yeah, always deadlines.
Yeah, that's usually what motivates everything. That company, was it a relatively new company?
PA Technology was part of the PA Consulting Group, which is a long-established management consultancy company. So that was a very big organisation. I then moved from PA to a company called Scientific Generics, and that was a breakaway from PA. That was very new, and again, trying to kind of develop new ways of working. So even line management, you could be line managed by somebody who was in a completely different discipline. Some of what we did worked, some of it didn't, but it was a really interesting environment and very long hours in that one.
That one was very long.
Yeah.
You knew the people before you shifted.
Mm-hmm.
And so had you been working closely with some of them?
Yeah.
And they said, we're going to go and do this new company. And you decided it would be a good thing to try. I think you mentioned that one of the main clients was from the US and that you went to Boston for a while and you were working there.
Yes.
And did you find that an adjustment at all, or did you think it was that fairly straightforward?
It was pretty straightforward because I was still working for the same company. I was there for 4 months. It was a really good experience, and I think I got a good feel for what it would have been like to work there longer term.
Did you find any cultural differences related to working there?
Just, little things like not having as much holiday.
that's noticeable, isn't it?
That's quite a big difference.
After about 11 years away from Scotland, you came back and you began to work with Scottish Enterprise. Was it always your goal to move back to Glasgow, or were you just tempted by this job at that time? What was your motivation, I guess?
I wanted to move on from consultancy. I had done that for about 4 or 5 years. You were asking about, was it long hours? And yes, overall it was relatively long hours with a bit of travel. And I felt that it was an environment that would be quite difficult to stay in really long term. I had enjoyed it and it was great experience. My choice was either to stay long term where I was or making the step to come back to Scotland. That was the time to make that decision. And I decided that if I could find the right job, I would come back to Scotland. Again, I got the job at Scottish Enterprise by applying to an advert.
That's great. That's great. Because I've always been told that does not work. Yeah. And then a number of people I've spoken to, they read an advert and they applied. And because I think you were there for quite a while. So that, I think, was a successful
position. And it was very much a change for me. I think that was probably part of my move as well, that I still had this interest in seeing technology work and applications, real world applications. But I guess I knew that I was going to move a bit further away from being hands-on, doing that development work myself. So the job at Scottish Enterprise, when I joined, I actually joined the telecoms team. which was two people, me and one other, was very interested in how Scottish businesses could benefit from the changes that were happening that time in telecoms technology, because we had just moved out of telecoms in the UK being a monopoly and moving into to having other players. So at that time, it was actually a duopoly. There were only the two companies. It seemed like an interesting move. It'd be risky, but I did it.
You did it. You managed it. So it seems like your work there was much more focused on business planning. Would you say that that's... How would you...
I would call it industry development.
Okay.
So working... I mean, Scottish Enterprise is a government agency. Its role has always been to support economic development. The work that I was doing, I moved from telecoms into working more in... actually the nascent optoelectronics team, because that was all just beginning to develop as being viewed as a separate industry sector within Scotland. And one day I was sitting at lunch with some colleagues and one of the senior managers was saying, do we know anything about optoelectronics? And what do you know, Karen? And I said, well, I've got a PhD in laser physics. So that was how that happened. We planned how we could support the developing optoelectronics industry in Scotland, and we helped set up an industry association. So worked with the sector as a whole and also with individual companies, and that was essentially myself and another guy who had worked there for a while, and he also had a background in physics and optics, so we were a good team.
When you say that you tried to find ways to support the industry, in what way could you do that?
There were mechanisms for providing financial support. Scottish Enterprise has got quite a substantial budget. So we could provide individual support under certain conditions to some companies. We set up the Optoelectronics Association, which helped the companies to network with each other and find out about opportunities, that kind of thing. We helped support exports. So Scottish Enterprise has a large exports division, so we'd help companies by organising trade missions, helping them go to overseas exhibitions, introducing them to international companies. So it was quite a wide range of things.
In terms of financial support to companies, or what would you say in terms of their financial support that you gave them?
It would more be for individual projects. So Scottish Enterprise is not providing sort of working capital for companies. There are other routes for that to happen, but to develop specific projects. So maybe within a company to develop a particular product, then Scottish Enterprise could contribute to that, but not fully fund it. So there always has to be some kind of matching funding or part of a wider project. So I guess quite a bit of it would be sort of networking and encouraging companies to apply for funding, to develop projects, to collaborate with others, things like that.
And it sounds like you were helping to target that funding in some ways, projects that you thought had better value.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. We also were involved in inward investment, trying to win overseas companies coming into Scotland to, at that time, largely to manufacture. There's a lot more sort of research and development now. Then it would be promoting what we had in Scotland to the potential inward investors.
Your work at Scottish Enterprise was focused on industry development.
We also worked with universities.
Oh, okay.
I should have mentioned that.
Okay.
Because particularly in the optoelectronics area, there was this sort of nascent industry, but there was also the strength that was already there across Scotland's universities. We tried to engage with that as well and encourage, say, some academics to come on some of the trade missions, that kind of thing, but also to sort of understand what was happening in academia and what might be the opportunities coming out of that.
You were doing a lot to support industry, but as I understand it, at that time you didn't have any formal business training. You developed this on your own, or you developed it as part of the work that you had done. Did you have to actively do that? Did you figure out, I need to learn about this, I need to read some books on that? Or did it just kind of happen as you were working on a project that there was a business aspect to it and you gained some knowledge and skills?
A mixture of the two. One of the good things about working at Scottish Enterprise was that there was very good in-house training. some of which was around the approach that Scottish Enterprise wanted to take to industry development. So there was a business academic in the States called Michael Porter, who was developing ideas about industry clusters and how clusters worked. And that would include the companies and the academia and all the kind of supporting aspects of an industry cluster. We had quite a lot of in-depth training around that. I also was able to do quite a lot of management training and leadership training, which was quite influential. It was a good place for in-house training.
You went on to work at the University of Strathclyde, and you were the chief executive for the Institute of Photonics. And you built up that team of the staff and postdoctoral researchers in that group. What was there? What was in place when you arrived, and how did you develop it?
I was invited to apply for the job. I was appointed in competition with about half a dozen other people who were interviewed. The whole idea of the Institute of Photonics was to have a commercially oriented research group within a university environment. When you look back at my technical consultancy career, it had quite a lot of similarities in a different environment, but there were some aspects of that part of my career which were hugely relevant. And also my Scottish Enterprise background was relevant because the Institute, when I joined, had some funding in place from the university itself, from Scottish Enterprise and its partner organisation, Glasgow Development Agency, and it had some industry support through what was Pilkington's at the time, now Talus. That package was in place with an outline plan for, I think, a five-year business plan, and there was space allocated in the university. So when I joined, I was the first employee. There were empty labs, empty office, no staff. It was definitely D1. We recruited, so the technical director of the Institute was an academic within the physics department who had secured the funding. It was his idea. He was our technical director. That was the start. We had funding in place to recruit some research team leaders and some support staff, a couple of technicians. I was responsible really for everything to do with the Institute and really running it as a small business. Although it was within the university environment, we were responsible for our own income and expenditure. We didn't get any losses written off. We were on a rolling budget. I had some ideas about how I would like that group to work. We were all new staff. We didn't have any academics from departments joining the Institute. Being all new, we had the opportunity to kind of set our own culture. The team leaders that we recruited all had industry experience. They were all PhD physicists, but they had worked in industry as well as in academia. We secured some funding, got some support for PhD students, and built it up to kind of about 50 staff and PhD students.
The people that you were hiring, was it fairly straightforward to find people who were already based in Scotland, or were you recruiting from outside Scotland?
We were recruiting from outside Scotland. The core were three research team leaders who, I would say, on the academic way of looking at life, they would be kind of senior lecturer, reader kind of experience. And they all came from outside of Scotland. We advertised, but we also used our networks to encourage people to apply.
So you were the chief executive, which sounds like a lot of power, but it also sounds like a lot of responsibility. Mm. I'm sure that you were very involved in everything, but you probably also had to delegate some to others. And how did you find it being in that position where you were responsible, but also having to maybe give some of that responsibility to other people?
Being chief executive of the Institute let me use what I had learned about management and leadership, and it allowed me to develop my own style of how I wanted to work. I used elements of training that I'd done. I used the experience of working in technical consultancy, where we had quite a flat structure and quite a sort of interesting approach to putting project teams together. So I think I tried to apply that. By that time in my career, I mean, it was mid-30s, I had quite a clear view of how I wanted to operate. as chief executive, there were some things that were clearly my job, certainly initially, things to do with the finances, the marketing, the business development. But I wasn't a researcher, so my job was to allow these great team leaders that we'd recruited to do their job. So a lot of my job was to take away things that could be difficult for them, or to help ensure that they had the right environment to operate. So that was one aspect of it. The other aspect was that over a period of time, I developed the person that we recruited as my PA initially was with me right through. In fact, she stayed 17 years in the Institute of Photonics, but she developed from being my PA to basically being the administration manager. So she looked after all the finances, she looked after all the HR issues, she looked after students when they arrived, all those kind of things, and she trained more admin staff as they were needed. I delegated quite a lot, but tried to make sure that I understood which bits of the job had to stay with me. But that was sort of inside the Institute. Outside the Institute, I had the university to deal with. That was the other side of my job, was kind of facing out towards the Faculty of Science and the university. There would be reporting, quite a lot of negotiation about space and about finance, and dealing with all of that was clearly part of my job.
So can you describe some of the things that you found really useful, or what you found comfortable ways of working in terms of being a leader or a manager?
I realised that my management style is quite inclusive. If I'm in a management position, I manage by consultation a lot of the time. Sometimes you do then have to make the hard decision if it's not working. But going back to what I was saying about, I saw my role as enabling the Institute to operate. I thought it was important to involve people in the management, really. So we would have strategy days. The more senior people, we would set our strategy for the year. We would have all staff days once a year so that everybody was involved and understood what the Institute was about, what we were trying to achieve, what our successes had been, what our issues were. If I'm in a management position, then I like to be consultative and approachable, I hope. An open door. And that, I think, was kind of distilled from the previous experiences, previous work that I had done. And it seemed to work quite well.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you worked in some really great places in terms of you had great managers and you could kind of pick up things from them as you went along too. And in addition, you could take training that exposed you to more ideas.
I mean, there's the other side of that as well. I've also seen sort of management that I thought, I'm not going to do
like
things
it.
Like that.
The strategy that you developed included technical goals and generating income. I guess to me these seem like sort of two separate things, or two things to balance. A lot of times people don't think of universities as generating income. They think of them as applying for grants and getting money that way. But how did you handle that, or how did you make that happen?
The initial expectation was that the Institute would sit really between academia and industry, and that it would undertake a reasonable amount, undefined, but that quite a lot of its work would be working directly with industry. As it developed, it was clear that partly because of the way that we were set up to be responsible for our own income and expenditure on an ongoing basis, and that we were part of a university, that's actually a very difficult thing to do when you don't have the kind of underpinning support of teaching income or long-term grants, that kind of approach. Over time, we probably shifted a bit towards academia, but everything that we did, all the research that we were involved in, had commercial or an application orientation. We were doing things that we thought would be applicable in the short to medium term rather than real long-term research. So we did end up with quite a portfolio of research income from grants, and that was all driven by the research team leaders, but we also sought funding for major infrastructure as well, large pieces of kit from other sources like funding councils. It was a mixture, and the actual winning of the income was largely down to the team leaders, but in the context of a plan that we had all agreed. One of the team leaders was working in one area but wanted to develop his research in a new topic that looked as if it was going to become very interesting. Between us, we looked at how would we secure the support for the sort of infrastructure that was needed for that.
When you started there, you hired the first three. They were like senior lecturers. Mm. Did they end up staying for a while? Did you find that they worked well as a team?
One of them's still there.
One of them's still there. That's great, because that's over 20 years now, isn't it?
Yeah, we had the Institute had its 20th anniversary 2 years ago. One of the team leaders is still there. The second one stayed about the same length of time as I did and then went to a chair at another university. And the third one stayed for about 5 years, but then moved back to Holland for family reasons. I mean, there was reasonable stability.
So the Institute of Photonics is now the lead research partner in the UK's first Fraunhofer Institute. What does that mean? And what is a Fraunhofer Institute?
Fraunhofer Institutes are German research organisations. They are very much intermediary research and development organisations, and they are supported by the German government. Part of their ongoing funding comes from the German government, who view it as a mechanism to support industry. The number of Fraunhofers in Germany is something like about 60 or 70. I mean, there are a lot of Fraunhofers, and over sort of recent years, they've developed international collaborations. And they have some activities in the States, some activities elsewhere in Europe, but they hadn't had an activity in the UK. It's interesting because it kind of ties back to my time at Scottish Enterprise, because when I was at Scottish Enterprise, there was always this ambition to bring the Fraunhofer organisation into Scotland as part of the sort of Scottish ecosystem of research and development and industry. It didn't happen at that time. When I left the Institute of Photonics, my successor, who had been my business development manager for a few years, he became chief executive, and he had a passion to bring Fraunhofer in. And over a period of time, he built up some relationships with Fraunhofer, and Strathclyde University was extremely positive about it. Plans were put in place with another hat. I had already left the Institute, but I ended up doing some of the work on the business planning for it. They decided that they would come to Scotland with support from the Scottish government. So the Scottish government have invested in it. But now we have there's the Institute of Photonics at Strathclyde with about 50 people. There's Fraunhofer sitting beside that with, I think, also about 50 people now. They've been going about 6 years. And in many ways, the Fraunhofer has filled that gap that 20-odd years ago was the ambition for the Institute. That gap between academia and industry has been filled by the Institute and Fraunhofer.
They work very closely. They still work
they
very
do,
closely together.
Yeah. And the team leader who joined 2 months after me, he's the research director of Fraunhofer.
During this time when you were the chief executive, how did you spend your time? I mean, I know maybe there wasn't a typical day. Did you have a kind of work pattern?
It varied. It changed quite a lot as the Institute grew. Right at the beginning, I was doing everything from choosing the lab benches to deciding what IT we should have to recruiting people to designing a logo to organising an opening event. In the early days, it was very, very varied and very practical. As the Institute became established, and we had kind of settled down to maybe about 40, 45 people, then I would say that my job was probably 30% managing people. That would range from sort of formal management meetings, strategy sessions, through to day-to-day management of issues. If staff had issues that they needed help with dealing with, then I would maybe get involved. Then, of course, a more formal development review and everything. I saw that as being really important. Maybe about 30% people management, maybe 20% finances, although that was very much supported by the admin manager. But I would still be quite involved in, you know, managing How budgets were going, how we were going to pay people, all those kind of things that you have
questions
to deal with. So maybe about 20-25%, maybe about the same, maybe 20% dealing with the university, reporting through the research management and the faculty, negotiating with the Dean of Science for some extra space, making sure that the Institute was kind of promoted within the university. We're talking to other academics about what we were doing, looking for kind of new collaborations, maybe a bit of that. And then probably about the same. This adds up to more than 100, doesn't it? External sort of communications, going to meetings, making presentations about the Institute, talking to potential funders, often alongside the research team leaders.
If I added everything up correctly, it sounds about half your time was inward work in terms of managing money, managing people.
Mm.
And the other half was working maybe to establish new collaborations and communicate with others outside of your own organization.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of looking at it, yeah.
I think you were there for about 9 years.
Yeah.
And then you left.
Yeah.
The Institute had grown and changed a lot in that time in a very positive way. So what made you decide to move on?
I felt that I had done the job. My involvement had started from building something and it had moved into a different phase, which was about maintaining the organisation. That was fine. I had done that for quite a while, but I felt that I wanted something new to do. And I also felt that the Institute could probably benefit from somebody new as well. I made the decision to move on.
Then you moved to the University of Glasgow, yeah. And you were a director of research strategy there.
Mm.
Did you just hear about that position through other people, or did someone suggest you apply? Was it a network?
It was an ad. I actually left the Institute with nowhere to go.
Okay, you just knew your time there was done and you wanted...
But I felt that I wanted to move into wider research management in the universities. So I thought that that would be the next step, was to have a wider role. I left the Institute and I actually did a little bit of consultancy for Strathclyde. And then the job at Glasgow came up. I saw that as being an opportunity to work right across an institution, which would be really interesting.
At that time, the university had refocused their priorities and you led the development of a new 5-year research strategy. So how had priorities changed? And I guess also within a university, what is a research strategy?
The idea of having an institutional research strategy, which of course is kind of taking a very corporate view of a university, and often we take a very bottom-up view of a university in terms of research groups that do their own thing and determine what they want to do and set their own objectives, or a department that does the same. The idea of taking a corporate view and having a single research strategy for the institution can sometimes be seen as being a bit at odds with that bottom-up approach. But the idea of what we were trying to do was to provide a framework that the university could, the departments and the faculties could identify with and see how they fit within that strategy. And also from an institutional point of view, having a corporate approach then helps you determine what kind of resources you need and what kind of support you need to put in place and how you want to organise the institution.
In 2008, you led the university's submission to the research assessment exercise. So at that time it was the RAE.
That's correct, yes.
And the RAE is really important for universities. And you became an expert on the rules of RAE for 2008. How did you become an expert in that topic?
By learning the guidance to the extent that I could tell you what page different bits of guidance were on. A mixture of the RAE as it was then and REF as it is now is a very clearly defined process run by the funding councils. So there is very clear guidance on what institutions are expected to do. The first thing is to understand the guidance, learn the guidance, know what you're being asked to do. But then a big part of that job was communicating that guidance to the assessment coordinators within the different departments within the university. So a big part of that job was about liaison, that we were the central office that was running the exercise, but the preparation of the submissions was being done at a discipline level. We were responsible for training people who were putting together the submissions, but then there was also an external aspect to it. There's a Scottish REE managers group. The REE team centrally within the funding councils, they run training events. There's a lot of different ways of getting information and also discussing the guidance with others who are in the same position without in any way jeopardising your own submission, but more talking to people who are doing the same job as you to make sure that you're understanding what's required.
You moved to the University of Strathclyde and you became the Special Projects Executive. And here you led on cross-departmental research projects. Mm. And it sounds like research at that time was becoming more interdisciplinary and that financing and management maybe had to adapt to this new way of working. Maybe you could describe the work that you did there, and it sounds like you also contributed to creating the TIC.
So they were all part of really the same project. Mm-hmm. So the idea of the TIC, Technology and Innovation Centre, was about creating a space where there would be better opportunities for collaborative and interdisciplinary research. Part of what I got involved in was working with the estates people and with the senior officers. So at that time, I worked for one of the deputy principals for research. One aspect of it was looking for ways to develop the funding for something like the TIC. Alongside that, we were kind of looking at what the building might look like, working with architects for ideas about how you would create those kind of environments, and trying to understand which parts of the university would be sensibly sort of located within TIC. And there's a lot of drivers in that. Some of that's disciplinary. Some of it's actually just about the estate and where there's the need for new facilities. Once that project started to develop, the work then kind of moved on to working with the academics that were going to be in the building to look at how their research fitted together, almost different ways of looking at their research. So rather than looking at it from a disciplinary basis, beginning to look at it from a, well, which industry sectors is this relevant to? What are the collaborative things? If you've got these disciplines, how do they in partnerships sort of feed into research in a particular sort of cross-disciplinary area, maybe medical devices or something like that. Started working on that and working with the academics. But then if you take a step behind that, if you're going to implement those kind of structures, your finance has to be able to accommodate that. So we had to look at how did we need to modify our finance systems to be able to not just count income as belonging to a department, but belonging to a cross-disciplinary theme as well, and possibly belonging to a market. That sounds very much behind the scenes and maybe not that important, but actually it's quite relevant in order to understand what research you are doing and how you then go out and sort of win more funding.
I almost think of it as the floor that you're going to build on. I also think it's really interesting that with the TIC, there's this physical building now that has the intention and design to promote interdisciplinary work and also work between academia and industry.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually quite interesting going into TIC now, because the public area around reception is always busy. There's always people in just having a chat, and it's been used as an informal sort of meeting hub as well, which is a really good outcome.
You then went to work for the Higher Education Funding Council for England. Did that involve moving to England or you stayed in Scotland?
That was a secondment from Strathclyde.
Okay.
And it ties back into REF. Uh-huh. So when I was back at Strathclyde, I was, as well as the work that I was doing around TIC and interdisciplinarity, I was also acting as an advisor to the REF team. So they had a team that were implementing the REF for 2014, and there were some aspects of that that I helped with. I had wanted to become a panel advisor. The way the REF operates is that when it comes to the assessment phase, so all the universities make their submissions and then it all has to be assessed, and that's all done over the period of a year with, at the moment, 32 panels, discipline-based panels of academics. some industry and other involvement as well. And in order to support those panels to provide a secretariat for that, the funding councils recruit secondments from across the UK universities. And I really wanted to do that because having seen an RAE and a REF from the institutional side, I was really interested in seeing it from the assessment side. Mm-hmm. Again, I applied to be a panel advisor and I was successful in getting that. Mm-hmm. And I spent a year and a bit, and there had been a little bit earlier on in the cycle that we supported them writing the guidance as well. But the bulk of it was the whole of 2014. I was seconded and worked with physical science and engineering panels, keepers of the guidance.
Interspersed between other positions, you've worked as a consultant. And what do you feel are the benefits of working this way? And what are the challenges?
Well, the challenges are making sure that you've got a steady flow of work, that you can balance going out to look for work with actually delivering work. That's a challenge. I think the benefit is that you can get involved in different topics if you've got the network in order to identify where there are opportunities. I worked completely for myself and it's been really for quite short periods. And sometimes it's led into an employment. Sometimes it hasn't. Depending on the stage that you're at in your career, then I wouldn't be afraid of consultancy and working for yourself because there are opportunities there if you know what you can do.
So it sounds like having a very good network and connection to organisations is really critical for
Absolutely.
That. Yeah. And it also seems like you must be very self-motivated that you're working for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, but networking is so important kind of right across a career, to maintain, develop networks, maintain networks, keep networks alive. You never know when somebody that you met a while ago might become just the person that you need to talk to. Yeah, definitely.
You got an LLB from Glasgow Caledonian in 2008. So what is it? Because I don't know. What is an LLB?
It's a law degree.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
So you just did that part-time.
Why?
And has that been helpful for you?
I did it because I've always been interested in the law. And I think going back to when I went to university, if I hadn't been quite so motivated to do science, then my second choice would probably have been to do a law degree. I found that in some of the work that I was involved in with the Institute of Photonics, I was dealing with lawyers, either to do with contractual things or to do with setting up collaborative projects. And we had one collaborative project which was actually a company limited by guarantees, so you spend a lot of time talking to lawyers involved with, you know, intellectual property, how you protect intellectual property, how we exploit it. I'd been coming in contact with quite a lot of legal things as part of that job, and I just quite like studying, and I thought I know some bits. I'd really like to fill in the gaps and have a rounder understanding of the law. So I did a part-time law degree.
So how long, doing it part-time, how long did that take?
It took me 3.5 years. If you didn't already have a degree, it was 4.5.
And so were you able to do that outside of regular working hours?
It was evenings, 2 evenings a week.
And did you find that quite challenging to be working in the daytime and doing law school in the evening?
I guess it is quite a challenge, and it was also my final term coincided with the REE 2008 submission, so I was very busy. I had a very supportive home life. I couldn't have done it if I hadn't had that support from home, and also it would have been more difficult if I had been going from job to something which was directly connected to my work. I think that would have been more difficult, but it was doing something quite different. I think that made it easier.
It seems to me that you really enjoy working with people and that you worked to train staff and help them develop within the organizations where you have worked. Is that something that you recognized early on? Have you always been good at working with others and managing others? Or do you think that's a skill that you had to develop or that you wanted to develop? Or do you actually hate working with people?
You're just very good at stand people, Linda.
You're just very good at
acting. No. I think that's... I realized quite early on in my career that I was not going to be a high-flying, hands-on academic researcher, but I was really interested in the subjects and I got a lot of satisfaction out of understanding what was happening in research, and I was just genuinely interested in physics. Maybe the early parts of my career opened my eyes to how people are managed by being managed myself. I enjoyed being able to enable people to do their jobs because that's what I view a manager as. I view a manager as an enabler. I enjoyed that, and I had the opportunity to do some relevant training. And then I had the opportunity with the Institute of Photonics, which I think was, when I was appointed, the appointing panel took a bit of a risk because my career wasn't leading directly to that point. And I remember thinking, this is a bit risky. But then you think, well, if you don't take a chance, then you don't know what you can achieve with it. If it hadn't worked out, it's not the end of the world, just go and do something else. I've had a role there that I enjoyed and I developed my skills, and I had a really good team of people. We were quite a tight, collaborative team. I was very clear about the culture that I wanted to have.
You say that they took a risk, but I think you said they interviewed about 6 people. Mm. So you must have done something okay.
Yeah, I guess
so. They must have seen you as the most risky. Over time, if you look back, how has your approach to work changed? And can you think of some of those sort of steps or developments in the way that you work or the way that you think about things?
I think maybe one thing that comes over time is recognising what's important, and maybe more importantly, recognising what's not important. And I guess that's related to being able to prioritise. Mm-hmm. Maybe earlier on in my career, you start at the beginning and you get to the end, but maybe not as much kind of thinking time before
reflecting.
You start, and actually identifying what are the priorities and what are the aspects of this work that are maybe nice to have, but not actually on your critical path. Somebody once said to me, you have to work out which battles to fight.
I think in the beginning, I didn't know that some things you could shrug them off.
Yes.
I think I'm much better at that now, just letting some things go.
Yeah. My career's been a bit unusual in terms of the steps that I've taken and the range of organisations. It's an interesting question when somebody says, well, what's your job? What do you do? Having spent a big bit of my career in universities in various ways, I tend to say, oh, I work in research management universities, and that's probably a good catch-all. But the earlier part of my career was a bit more of a random walk, but interesting jobs. But the organisations were trying to find different ways of working as well. And I think that, I suppose that taught me that you can do things differently, that you don't have to have a clear hierarchy, and you know, there are different ways of organising. Yeah, there isn't one straightforward way of doing things. And you have to find your own style. I do a bit of mentoring now, and that's what I say, you know, you have to find your own style. And if you can find your own style and the way you like to work, then you'll always be consistent in management. There's nothing worse than an inconsistent manager.
If you could go back at any point in time and advise your younger self, what would you say?
I'm not absolutely sure I should have done a PhD. Okay. Now that I've done it, I'm glad that I did it. But for me, it was a struggle. And now that I look back, I was not well managed as a PhD student.
Sure.
But I didn't know that at the time. I think maybe my piece of advice was, you don't always have to be perfect. And I'm not sure I did the right PhD. Maybe that's more it. Maybe, you know, I have this, there's a bit of me that thinks, I'd really like to do another PhD. Because now I'd know how to do it.
Well, thank you very much for speaking today.
Thanks, Linda.